Yes, it's January 30th, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 19:03 hours Eastern Standard Time. Ward Green with you again. The cartouche of Apophis is this illustration here on the right, the far right of this photo, with where there are three what look like, maybe those are scarabs. A scarab is like a beetle shaped, or the shape of the back of a beetle. But this is the cartouche of Apophis on the far right. And what it looks like, if we see it in writing, is we're just in the article, The Crucible of Credible Creed, just before chapter 6, paragraph 5, which we're about to read. That's the cartouche of Apophis right there, the text version of it. In our text, looks like that, or that's probably an illustration, actually. A graphic image rather than text, because we don't use the Egyptian alphabet. But that's the Egyptian alphabet, and that is the cartouche of Apophis in their alphabet. His throne name, which we know was Akinenri at one point in his career. Sir Lancelot Brenton's translation of the Greek Septuagint has the words, quote, another king, end quote, who did not know Joseph, with the possible interpretation of different king, in quotes, different king, or usurper of the Hyksos, who got power in Egypt after Joseph's death. Right, so he could have been a usurper after the Hyksos even took power. Yet he was, we also believe, Semitic, or from the same part of the world as the Hyksos. In other words, this is interesting, yeah, no, but they were Hyksos, and they were forcing the people to work, according to the Bible, because they built the cities that were mentioned in the Bible. The Bible account further identifies the north of Egypt as the place of the ruler, Apophis, although he wasn't mentioned by name in the Bible. But that ruler was ruling in the north of Egypt, and that's identified in the Bible because it mentions the cities' names, Pithom, Ramesses, and On, all of which are northern cities in the delta, in other words, of Egypt, the northern part of Egypt. Thank God for his word, for it is from this Exodus account, the book of Exodus, that we get an important piece of information about Israel in the day of Moses, which is they lived in northern Egypt. Now, in Joseph's days, which were many, many years prior, Israel had lived there when there was one pharaoh who said that Israel could live in northern Egypt. That's from, of course, the book of Genesis, where the pharaoh gave them permission to live in northern Egypt. We're not going to look up the scriptures. You should do that if you're interested. In many translations, it's, I believe, Genesis chapter 47, where that's talked about in the footnotes 4 and 5. In many translations, the part of Egypt where Jacob and his sons lived was Goshen. It's called Goshen, where they lived, which was a place that most translations describe as, quote, the best of the land, unquote, of Egypt. It's the most fertile place in Egypt, which is just the Nile Delta region, because of its fertile soil, amid a desert, right? Just Egypt is a desert, except for the very few oases or places of fertile land, such as the Nile Delta, which was one of the very few, the Fayum region being another one. And that Fayum region was associated with Joseph, according to the fact that there was a canal that was named Joseph's Canal. And there's a story about how that came into being, too, that was told by the ancient writers And Zechariah Sitchin mentions that. It's in one of our articles. Brown Driver Briggs' Hebrew definition says, quote, Goshen, unquote, means, quote, a region in northern Egypt, east of the lower Nile, where children of Israel lived, unquote. And then another quote, from the time of Joseph to the time of Moses, unquote. And the exception we note is that Jesus' mother also visited briefly this part of Egypt with Jesus in her womb, or I should say, no, this is after the birth of Jesus when they fled to Egypt, right? When Jesus was actually a very young child, and Joseph and the mother of Jesus actually traveled to Egypt to get away from King Herod the Great. So that's the end of our study for today. It's fascinating, isn't it? Little children, and Proverbs. For today, we have Proverbs chapter 1, verse 2. The purpose of Proverbs is for one to know wisdom and discipline, to discern the sayings of understanding. That's our proverb for today. Now, little ones and everyone, welcome to our study of 2 Kings chapter 14. In the second year of Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, the king of Israel, Amaziah, the son of Jehoash, the king of Judah, became king. Now, that's interesting because when we look at our chronology, let's go to the chronology part of part two of Moses. The second year of Jehoash, the king of Israel, Amaziah became king. His second year would be about 840, because he was ruling in 842. Amaziah became king here, 839. Well, that would look like more like the third year, so it's a little bit of a problem, but not really, because we know that there was an eclipse here in 784. We've just chosen to write 785 because that's the way the numbers worked out from the year of Jehu, which we determined through much research that Jehu must have ruled from 887, because there's a record of him making a tribute to the king of Assyria, Shalmaneser III. Anyway, it's within 1 year, but if we lower these years by one, then this is 841 for Jehoash. That works out perfectly, but we're not going to lower year one of Jehu. There are enough uncertainties that 1 year can be easily accounted for without any discrepancy, so don't think it's a problem at all. It's remarkably harmonious, in fact, that it works out as well as it does. But we're going to see in the next chapter there's a bit of a discrepancy in chapter 15 of 2 Kings. We're going to talk about that tomorrow. But that we can explain, as we can all the other discrepancies also. This is written, this book, 2 Kings, by Jeremiah, the prophet, and we don't know how reliable the records were that were used by him to write this book, but we know it's accurate enough that it's accurate enough we can find a very good chronology, and we did. 25 years old was Amaziah when he began to reign, and for 29 years he reigned in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Jehoadan of Jerusalem. And he continued to do what was upright in Jehovah's eyes, only not like David, his forefather. According to all that Jehoash, his father, had done, he did. Remember, there were two King Jehoashes, one in Israel and one in Judah, who was the father. The king of Judah, Jehoash, was the father of Amaziah. Let's just verify again, because sometimes father means grandfather. Amaziah's father was Jehoash, right. Jehoash was the young boy who was saved from the wicked Athaliah, who tried to kill all the sons of Ahaziah, right. And Ahaziah was her husband. She tried to kill all of his sons so that she could be queen. So Amaziah was the son of Jehoash, who was the son of Ahaziah. But in the days of Amaziah, it was only the high places. It was only that the high places did not disappear. That was his sin that he committed. Otherwise, he was faithful to what his father had done. Of course, his father had also been unfaithful in that regard. The people were still sacrificing and making sacrificial smoke on the high places. Well, if we look at what did Jehoash do in chapter 13. I believe all of these kings typically were unfaithful. Right. That was talking about the kings of Israel. Jehoash became king, right. And this is it, is it? For 40 years he reigned in Jerusalem, right, in the seventh year of Jehu, who was the northern king, the king of Israel. But Jehoash, the king of Judah, the southern king, it was the high places did not disappear. In verse 3, the same for him as it was for his son, Amaziah. Let's look at what we're reading today. Here we go. So it was only that the high places did not disappear. That was their one thing that they did wrong. The people were still sacrificing and making sacrificial smoke on the high places. And it came about that as soon as the kingdom had become firm in his hand, Amaziah, this is, he began to strike down his servants that had struck down the king, his father, because his father had been killed by rebels. And the son of the strikers he did not put to death, according to what is written in the book of Moses' law, that Jehovah gave in command, saying, quote, fathers should not be put to death for sons, and sons themselves should not be put to death for fathers, but for his own sin should each one be put to death. Makes it sound like, well, we all die because we're sinners. It makes it sound like everyone should be put to death, which is the wrong interpretation. We should also be given the opportunity to make amends for our sin, too. But he himself struck down, this is Amaziah, struck down the Edomites in the Valley of Salt, 10,000 men, and got to seize Selah in the war. Struck down the Edomites. And the name of Selah came to be called Jokthiel down to this day. Then it was that Amaziah sent messengers to Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, the king of Israel, saying, do come, let us look each other in the face. So he was aggressive, maybe, toward Jehoahaz. At that, Jehoash, the king of Israel, sorry, not Jehoahaz, it was Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, who was the son of Jehu. So Jehoash, the grandson of Jehu, then sent to Amaziah, the king of Judah, saying, quote, the thorny weed itself that was in Lebanon sent to the cedar that was in Lebanon, saying, do give your daughter to my son as a wife. However, a wild beast of the field that was in Lebanon passed by and trampled the thorny weed down. You have unmistakably struck down Edom, and your heart has lifted you up. Enjoy your honor and dwell in your own house. Why then should you engage in strife under unfavorable conditions and have to fall, you and Judah with you? And Amaziah did not listen. So Jehoash, the king of Israel, came up, and they proceeded to look each other in the face. Amaziah had said, do come, let us look each other in the face. Verse 8. He challenged him. And so they looked each other in the face, verse 11. He and Amaziah, the king of Judah, at Beth Shemesh, which belongs to Judah. And Judah came to be defeated before Israel, so that they took to flight, each one to his tent. And it was Amaziah, the king of Judah, the son of Jehoash, the son of Ahaziah. That's the descent line we've been talking about, the kings of Judah. Amaziah, son of Jehoash, son of Ahaziah, who had married Athaliah. And Amaziah it was that Jehoash, the king of Israel, captured at Beth Shemesh. After which they came to Jerusalem, and he made a breach in the wall of Jerusalem. Listen to this. At the gate of Ephraim, clear to the corner gate, 400 cubits, the breach that he made. And he took all the gold. That's a big breach, more than, 600 feet approximately. Took all the gold and silver and all the articles to be found at the house of Jehovah and in the treasures of the house of the king and the hostages, and then returned to Samaria. As for the rest of the affairs of Jehoash, who was the king at that time of Israel, what he did and his mightiness and how he fought against Amaziah, the king of Judah, are they not written in the book of the affairs of the days of the kings of Israel? Finally, Jehoash lay down with his forefathers, and was buried in Samaria with the kings of Israel. And Jeroboam, his son, began to reign in place of him. He would be Jeroboam the second, Jeroboam having had the kingship of Israel at the very beginning of the split of the kingdom, splitting off as it did from the larger kingdom of Israel, which had originally included all the tribes. And when it split, there were only two tribes that remained with the southern kingdom, and the 10 tribes had been with Jeroboam. And Amaziah, well, it's actually there were half tribes as well, but there were essentially 12 tribes, because Levi didn't get any inheritance and Joseph got two parts. And Amaziah, the son of Jehoash, the king of Judah, continued to live after the death of Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, the king of Israel, for 15 years. That's our chronology again, right? 15 years after the death of Jehoash. Amaziah died in 810 BCE in our chronology. And Jehoash died in about 25. We said we could lower these by 1 year, since the eclipse is 784 and not 785. So it is 15 years after the death of Jehoash if we lower those by 1 year. But we've kept it 1 year higher for a reason, because we know that Jehu is 887 here, according to the very best information that we can gather. So it's still very accurate. Maybe it is 15 years and some months. And so there's no contradiction that we're aware of. It's just that the chronology is very, very good. As for the rest of the affairs of Amaziah, are they not written in the book of the affairs of the days of the kings of Judah? At length, that's Amaziah. At length they leagued against him in a conspiracy, just as they conspired against his father at Jerusalem, and he went fleeing to Lachish, but they sent in pursuit of him to Lachish and put him to death there. So there were problems with conspirators in the kingdom of Judah in those days. And they carried him upon horses, and he was buried in Jerusalem with his forefathers in the city of David. Then all the people of Judah took Azariah, he at the time being 16 years old, and they made him king in place of his father Amaziah. And he later also was called Uzziah, we see. We know he has more than one version of his name. He's called Uzziah as well as Azariah. And he ruled 53 years according to the scriptures, or 52 years actually according to the scriptures, officially in the scriptures. Okay, in the 15th, okay, here it is, year of Amaziah, in the 15th year of Amaziah. Well, yeah, that's the part we haven't got to. Azariah was 16 years old, right? Right. He himself built Elath and got to restore it to Judah after the king lay down with his forefathers. In the 15th year of Amaziah, the son of Jehoash, the king of Judah, in his 15th year, so this is before the death of Amaziah, the son of Jehoash, the king of Israel, became king in Samaria for 41 years. So the 15th year of Amaziah would be about 834, right? Or 824, 15 years after 839, 824, and actually, yeah, or it would be more like 825, 14 years after 839, and here we have, look, 826, we're again 1 year high, and that's exactly perfect, considering the eclipse is 1 year lower, so 825 would be, if we adjusted it, the same as that number, 14 years after 839, so it's perfect. Again, the chronology, continued to do what was bad in Jehovah's eyes. This king, Jeroboam, the son of Jehoash, he did not depart from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, with which he caused Israel to sin. He was the first king of Israel, and this was his namesake, Jeroboam the second. He it was that restored the boundary of Israel from the entering in of Hamath, clear to the sea of the Arabah, according to the word of Jehovah, Arabah being the salt sea, the God of Israel who spoke by means of his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet that was from Gath-Hepher, for Jehovah had seen the very bitter affliction of Israel. There was neither any helpless one nor any worthless one, nor was there a helper for Israel, and Jehovah had promised not to wipe out the name of Israel from under the heavens. Consequently, he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Jehoash, who was the king of Israel. But this is interesting because Jonah is mentioned, so we know this should give us a timeline for when Jonah was involved in the preaching, and I haven't remembered now to do. I want to do this research. We don't have time to do it today, but we're going to have to research again Jonah and how he fits in with the timeline here. As for the rest of the affairs of Jeroboam and all that he did and all his mightiness, this is Jeroboam the second, how he fought and how he restored Damascus and Hamath to Judah and Israel. Are they not written in the book of the affairs of the days of the kings of Israel? There are lots of interesting things talked about here. Finally, Jeroboam lay down with his forefathers with the kings of Israel, and Zechariah, his son, began to reign in place of him. I want to look up Jonah, but we'll have to try and get there. So see, there was an interregnum where no king ruled for 12 and a half years, roughly, there. And then Zechariah, the son of Jeroboam, began to rule here in 772 BCE in our chronology, right? And that's, he's said to have begun to rule in the 38th year of, we're going to see that tomorrow, of Azariah, the king of Judah, who reigned from 810, the 38th year would be 772. 38 years after, so that's the right time. But we got to move on, we got to look up Jonah tomorrow, or I'm going to do that tonight. I'm fascinated to know more about Jonah. I'm very interested in chronology every day. My research never stopped. I mean, I continue to research the chronology every day that I could learn something new. Ezekiel 38, and the word of Jehovah continued to occur to me, saying, Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog, the head chieftain of Meshach and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and you must say, This is what the Sovereign Lord Jehovah has said. Here, I am against you, O Gog, you head chieftain of Meshach and Tubal. Oh, I had another idea about how Jehovah's name was pronounced recently. I thought about it. It made really good sense. That there's another way. The Yahweh can be pronounced Yahweh. That could be Jehovah's name, Yahweh. That could be it. Because the pronunciation of the divine name, Jehovah, has been lost. Some people say Yahweh was the correct pronunciation. Other people say Jehovah. But I just came to the realization recently, it could be Yahweh, which is incredible. It's amazing. It's fantastic. I mean, phenomenal, because it changes the way you think of it in the English language if it's pronounced Yahweh. And I certainly shall turn you around and put hooks in your jaws and bring you forth with all your military force, Gog, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed in perfect taste, a numerous congregation with large shield and buckler, all of them handling swords, Persia, Ethiopia, and put with them all of them with buckler and helmet, Gomer and all its bands, the house of Tagarma, of the remotest parts of the north and all its bands, many peoples with you. Be ready, and let there be preparation on your part, you with all your congregation, those congregated alongside you, and you must become their guard. After many days you will be given attention. In the final part of the years you will come to the land of people brought back from the sword, collected together out of many peoples, onto the mountains of Israel, that have proved to be a constantly devastated place, even a land that has been brought forth from the peoples, where they have dwelt in security, all of them. And you will be bound to come up. Like a storm you will come in, like clouds to cover the land you will become, you and all your bands and many peoples with you. This is what the Sovereign Lord Jehovah has said, Gog, and it must occur in that day that things will come up into your heart, and you will certainly think up an injurious scheme, and you must say, I shall go up against the land of open rural country. I shall come in upon those having no disturbance, dwelling in security, all of them dwelling without wall, and they do not have even barren doors. It will be to get a big spoil and to do much plundering. What does that remind you of? In order to turn your hand back upon devastated places re-inhabited, and upon a people gathered together out of the nations, one that is accumulating wealth and property, those who are dwelling in the center of the earth. Well, it applies to the final times, the end times. You know, that's what's supposed to happen during the time, just about the time of Armageddon and the end of the wicked system. Sheba and Dedan, according to the book of Revelation, and the merchants of Tarshish and all its maned young lions, they will say to you, is it to get a big spoil that you are coming in? Is it to do much plundering that you have congregated your congregation in order to carry off silver and gold, to take wealth and property, to get a very great spoil? Therefore prophesy, O son of man, and you must say to Gog, this is what the Sovereign Lord Jehovah has said. Will it not be in that day when my people Israel are dwelling in security that you will know it? You will certainly come from your place from the remotest parts of the north, you and many peoples with you. They came from the north. It's fascinating. All of them riding on horses, a great congregation, even a numerous military force. Does that sound like Russia? I don't know. It's got some similarities. And you will be bound to come up against my people Israel like clouds to cover the land in the final part of the days that will occur. And I shall certainly bring you against my land for the purpose that the nations may know me when I sanctify myself in you before their eyes, O Gog. But he's coming against Jehovah's people, though. This Gog. This is what the Sovereign Lord Jehovah has said. Are you the same one of whom I spoke in the former days by the hand of my servants, the prophets of Israel, who were prophesying in those days, years, as to bringing you in upon them? And it must occur in that day, in the day when Gog comes in upon the soil of Israel, is the utterance of the Sovereign Lord Jehovah, that my rage will come up into my nose. And in my ardor, in the fire of my fury, I shall have to speak. Surely in that day a great quaking will occur in the soil of Israel, and because of me the fish of the sea and the flying creatures of the heavens and the wild beasts of the field and all the creeping things that are creeping on the ground and all mankind that are upon the surface of the ground will be bound to shiver, and the mountains will actually be thrown down and the steep ways will have to fall, and the earth to the earth, even every wall will fall. Every wall will fall to the earth, and I will call forth against him throughout all my mountainous region a sword. Against Gog is the utterance of the Sovereign Lord Jehovah. Against his own brother, the sword of each one will come to be. So Gog will kill himself, basically, and I will bring myself into judgment with him with pestilence and with blood and a flooding downpour and hailstones, fire and sulfur. I shall rain down upon him and upon his bands and upon the many peoples that will be with him. And I shall certainly magnify myself and sanctify myself and make myself known before the eyes of many nations, and they will have to know that I am Jehovah. That's the end of Ezekiel 38, but I want to look at First Peter a little bit, just tiny bit, if we can, with the time that's remaining. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, he wrote two letters, the first and second of Peter. We looked at Second Peter yesterday, I believe. But today, I don't really want to read this particular thing right now, but I want to look at what Clark says about it. It's fascinating. His commentary on First Peter, he gives some information that he doesn't give regarding Second Peter, because he's already talked about it in First Peter. He says, in the place called Bethsaida, which was mentioned by Jesus, this is where Simon was born, but he's quoting from Dr. Lardner and Professor Michaelis. He talks about and the land of Palestine, in quotes, says cave. At and before the coming of our blessed Savior was distinguished into three several provinces, Judea, Samaria, and Galilee. In the upper, called also Galilee of the Gentiles, or nations, within the division belonging to the tribe of Naphtali, stood Bethsaida, formerly an obscure and inconsiderable village, till lately re-edified and enlarged by Philip the Tetrarch, and in honor of Julia, daughter of Augustus, called by him Julius. It was situated, Julius with an A-S at the end, it was situated upon the banks of the Sea of Galilee, was the city Bethsaida, and the Sea of Galilee was also called the Lake of Tiberias and the Lake of Gennesaret, and it was about 40 furlongs in breadth and 100 in length, and had a wilderness on the other side called the Desert of Bethsaida, whither our Savior used often to retire. At this place was born Simon, surnamed Cephas, or Petrus, Peter, signifying a stone or fragment of a rock. He was a fisherman upon the aforementioned lake or sea. He just says forementioned. We say aforementioned. As was also in all probability his father, Jonah, or John. He had a brother named Andrew, which was the eldest of the two, is not certain. For concerning this, there were different opinions among the ancients. Epiphanius supposed Andrew to be the elder, but according to Chrysostom, Peter was the firstborn. So likewise Bede and Cassian, or Bede and Cassian, who even make Peter's age the ground of his precedence among the apostles. And Jerome himself has expressed himself in like manner, saying, quote, that the keys were given to all the apostles alike, and the church was built upon all of them equally, but for preventing dissension, precedency was given to one. John might have been the person, but he was too young, and Peter was preferred on account of his age, according to Jerome. And that's the end of our study for today. We have January 30th, 2024, of the Common Era, 1937 hours Eastern Standard Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. In my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie. But I want to say, what do you think? When is the price of electric cars going to drop by 50%? As soon as you buy one, it's the answer. Bye for now.